Halfway down that paragraph, it reads, "Some tollway locations will involve existing traffic noise levels that already approach or exceed the NAC. Under these conditions, even if the proposed project will not cause the traffic noise levels to increase above existing levels, traffic noise abatement will be considered." Could you just elaborate on that a little bit?
If we've got sections of roadway that already are exceeding the threshold, 67 decibels, it's basically saying if we're already above, say if we're at the 70 decibels in some of these existing areas, we're doing the project, we would come in and actually build a wall because we're already exceeding the threshold.
So those would be areas where we're doing some new work?
We're doing some new work out there, and it's areas that we have a few of those where the levels are already exceeding. So it still gives us the opportunity to go back and do it. I believe Eden Spur would be an example of something like that, where we did some work 3 years ago, maybe, Paul?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 2 years ago on Eden Spur, where there were some existing homes that were already exceeding the existing noise level, and we came in and provided some noise abatement for those areas.
Good. One last question on the policy relative to the feasibility safe page.
Mm-hmm.
Noise reduction design goal. Noise reduction design goal will be 8 dBA
mm-hmm.
Or more at a minimum of one receptor location. However, the minimum acceptable noise reduction on the first row of receptors will be 5 dBA at a minimum of one receptor location. Can you elaborate a little bit on that as well?
So when we build, anytime we decide we're going to build some kind of noise wall, noise abatement, whatever it might be, our goal is always to achieve that 8 decibel. Actually, we shoot for 10. That's like cutting the noise in half, if you will. That's always what we're going to strive for. But a 5 decibel reduction is something that is definitely noticeable to the homes that are there. And what we want to do is make sure that we are achieving at least a 5 decibel reduction on that closest home, or some home in that area, or the receptor in that area. If we can't get a 5 decibel reduction within any reasonable measure, it could be that the home's just too far away to get that type of a reduction. It could be the topography of the roadway, or you're going to have to continue building a wall so high that it's going to be not cost effective. So what we really shoot for is to cut the noise down by 8 to 10 decibels. At a minimum, we'll accept 5. Eden Spur is another good example of this. One area we were able to achieve an 8 decibel, 10 decibel reduction on one side. The other side, we couldn't get that high within a cost-effective means. So we had some areas that received a 5 decibel reduction. Again, very noticeable. It was cost-effective from our viewpoint. So it gives us that ability to make sure that we're putting a wall in that's going to provide some benefit, quantifiable, measurable benefit, as opposed to just putting a wall in because somebody says we'd like to see a wall that really doesn't work.
Right. So the two very key criteria then really are, in this case, would be reaching, being able to attain that minimum reduction,
mm-hmm.
but that's also balanced against the cost.
Correct. You keep adding height on, you're going to keep adding cost. And at some point in time, you get to that point of diminishing return, you just add height and you're not getting a benefit. So this really just, it's simple modeling, traffic noise modeling. You just plug in numbers and heights, and it changes the noise and the cost of the wall.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
anything else? Right. So then at the now that it's up for comment, we'll let you know what comments we receive at the next strategic planning committee, and then hopefully we'll proceed with approval at that one, and we'll have our policy first one.
Very good.
Okay, so this next discussion topic, am I staying on course here? I think
number five.
Okay. This is more of a discussion topic. So as you've seen over the last couple of months, we bring a lot of intergovernmental agreements. I know there were a couple of them today that were shared with the board. There's going to be a lot more. But there's different types of agreements and cost sharing that we have on each one of these projects. And I just want to make sure that as we start developing our cost sharing and IGA policy, I get some feedback from the board. We can start working on modifying our policies. We don't actually have one in place right now. It's kind of informal of what we do. just want to make sure we're consistent across. We've got a couple different things. We've got intergovernmental agreements that, as I said, you know, come to the board for approval. These are binding contracts. We also have, we deal with letters of understanding. These are also binding contracts, but they're much simplified, much more simplified. Many of them don't involve direct financial participation. Sometimes these are, this is work that we are already planning on doing. For example, say landscape type work. Sometimes we don't have room to plant trees on our right-of-way, so we'll work with an adjacent community to put trees on their right-of-way to provide some level of mitigation for our work, also provide some screening. We do a lot of that through letters of understanding between us, an association, a community, whatever it might be. So we do these letters of understanding. We also do letters of understanding when we know there will be a future intergovernmental agreement. We know the cost terms of the project. We want to basically lock everybody down into a dollar amount. This is when it involves multiple parties. Lock people into a dollar amount knowing that an agreement will be following shortly thereafter. Then the third type of intergovernmental agreement is a memorandum of understanding. This is something that's really a precursor to an intergovernmental agreement. Most of these involve IDOT. These are where an intergovernmental agreement is going to follow not immediately after. It might take months or years for an intergovernmental agreement to start coming together. Examples of this would be some of our interchange projects where we know it's going to take some time for the project to mature, but we want to get some level of commitment from the different parties. I-90 at 47, for example, we have five different parties who signed on to a memorandum of understanding probably about 2+ years ago, maybe even longer, to say that we're all going to agree to move forward in a very specific way. It's always going to follow our interchange policy. IDOT's going to contribute money, and the locals are also going to participate in the project. So we do have these three different things: IGAs, LOUs, or memorandum of understandings.
And the last, really, the memorandum of understanding kind of helps if over time, mm-hmm. if you have a change in the makeup of the village board or city council,
right.
including the president or the mayor, that mm-hmm. it kind of keeps that understanding alive mm-hmm. through various
right.
administrations.
Yeah. It's not a binding agreement, but it's a
right.
It's a commitment on all parties. We had something similar with Oak Brook that I think went back to the 1990s. We had an agreement to say, here's how we're going to proceed, and when we started our construction in 2006 time frame, we went back to that MOU and said, okay, here's how we're going to move forward. And it really, you know, helped solidify. They like that, we like that, and I like that as well. So it was our mutual commitment. So let me just give you a snapshot of what we did as part of our previous program, are still our ongoing CRP. There was 158 intergovernmental agreements that were brought to the board, 37 letters of understanding, and 4 memorandums of understanding. This is between 2005 and 2011. The numbers aren't important necessarily, but it just really gets you the sense of the magnitude of what you're going to be seeing over the next several years. There's a lot of work that goes into these intergovernmental agreements. I just want to make sure as we move forward, we're approaching it consistently. Of those, we had 72 IGAs where there was reimbursement to the tollway, and 50 IGAs with the tollway paying out. So you can kind of get a gauge of what those dollar amounts were and are. But again, I just want this slide to get you the sense of the magnitude of what's going to be coming over the next several months. The types of IGA projects that you're going to be seeing are going to be for new interchanges. I know we've seen some of those recently. But we also have some local agency roadway improvements when we're out doing our improvements, whether it be on a bridge or a crossroad, whatever it might be. We go over somebody, we go under somebody. Local communities would like us to do some additional work as part of our construction. That's absolutely fine. But we want to make sure that we're getting reimbursed for that work. It makes sense to do it.
And not just local agencies, but sometimes the Illinois Department of Transportation.
Yes.
State agencies,
counties, it could be local agencies, it's anybody that when we're out there doing the work, it just makes sense to do it all at one point in time when you have it torn up. It inconveniences people only once. New roadways, we've got some IGAs to consider for Elgin O'Hare. We've got one for 355, other projects like that. Maintenance agreements are pretty typical where we assign maintenance between us and whatever other jurisdictions. It's typically on bridges. You'll see a lot of things for storm sewers and other structures. You know, from a local municipality standpoint, you could appreciate that. There's a lot of casings and storm sewer work that when we're out there doing our work, there's requests to add more work in. It could be for anybody, locals or IDOT. Lighting, existing roadways, future roadways, aesthetic lighting, whatever it might be. They said bridges, multi-use paths, sidewalks, we have a lot of agreements on those. Noise walls, we've got a formalized provision in our policy that, that we've actually are hopefully going to ratify it with the new policy, where we say what our commitment is going to be, where the locals also contribute anything above that dollar amount. Landscaping, we've got a lot of those that will come to you. Signage, bird spikes, those are the spikes that go on the bridges to keep the pigeons off. They're not really spikes, they're just kind of called bird spikes.
Think of a nicer name.
Well, they're pigeons. Ticklers, bird ticklers.
Bird ticklers, right.
They don't like them. And then for aesthetic improvement. So any of the aesthetic improvements that communities want and desire, we could incorporate those in our project. It makes sense. You see a lot of that on a bridge wall, I would say, right here at the 88th and 53 near the Morton Arboretum. We've done some aesthetic work there and other places as well. So these are the types of agreements that you will be seeing. Let me talk a little bit about the cost share levels, how we assign cost share levels. For newer expanded interchanges, we use our 2007 interchange policy. What this basically says, I'm going to break this down very simple, that the toll is in for 50% maximum contribution, and our contribution is based on net new revenue over a 10-year period. That's what we've established before. That's what we're moving on. There's, you know, it's been some discussion about that, equity-based issues there. Rural areas, and this is what we've established. It's worked to date, but there are some questions that are out there. We
Michael,
also
can I just say, sure. the term on the first bullet there is maximum. Mm-hmm. So I suspect, and correct me if I'm wrong, that if the revenue projected over the 10-year period amounts to less than 50%, that would be?
It would be adjusted accordingly.
Is there any assistance on the financing that we give local governments, especially when you get into rural areas where maybe they don't have the ability to?
Well, and that's, you know, that's why I want to really get to too. Is that, yeah, that's something that we need to consider. How do we approach this in those rural areas where you have you don't have the traffic command out there?
At least currently,
it takes time for areas to grow and mature. We've developed a policy that we have right now. It's been used. You know, how do we want to start looking at those rural areas?
Irene Road is an example of this.
Right. You know, Irene Road is I-90 to Irene Road. It's out in Belvedere. It's an area where we've got one leg of a ramp right now, and you know, how do we want to approach moving forward with that? If an area fits within our parameters of the interchange policy, the interchange spacing, and such, but it doesn't hit necessarily on the cost side of things.
Or actual upfront financing for the interchange for a community, and then allowing them to pay it off through whatever revenue stream they decide to use.
And we've done that. We did that on 355 yeah. on mm-hmm. some of those interchanges. I mean, it's always a balance of, you know, obviously then we are basically providing a loan
right.
and are in the business of collecting the payments.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's certainly something that's available.
I'm going to hit a few different things. I'll tell you how we've been approaching it. I just want to kind of tell you about how we establish the cost sharing levels. And then move on and talk about how we might want to do something different. Other ways we establish cost sharing levels is based on previous agreements that we have in place. If it's for bridges, typically on a bridge, there's a breakdown at the, there's a cost division at the bridge deck and above, and any the beams and below is how we historically have broken the bridge cost sharing down. So based on previous agreements, so anything on the top would be one agency, anything on the bottom would be a different agency, and if the widening goes on, it's shared equally.
But usually one agency coordinates the project.
That's an excellent point. Whoever is initiating the project, what we've adopted is whoever initiates the project, you're the one who has to develop the intergovernmental agreements and handle whatever materials are associated with it. So if it's an IDOT-initiated project, they're responsible for an IGA. If it's a tollway, it's us. If it's a local community, it's us. That's how it usually breaks down. But that's the way we pretty much approach it. Traffic noise and abatement cost share, you know, you had one, I believe, today, with this was with Green Oaks. They picked up 100% of the cost. Previous agreements with communities have been based on the number of receptors that have benefited. That's what we have in our policy now. If there's 10 receptors that are going to receive a benefit, our contribution is, say, $30,000 each. We're in for $300,000. If the wall costs $500, they would have to.
But typically, this has been for noise walls. I mean, one of the reasons that today is a little different is because this is a very atypical situation where we would actually go out and do work on the roadway. And I think the reason that we're doing it is because we happen to be mm-hmm. out doing work in that area anyway. That we can just add to and do it pretty conveniently and cost effectively for the community. So I think we talk about traffic noise abatement here, again, it's the wall.
This is the wall. This is absolutely
what we
just on
saw
the wall.
Today from Green Oaks.
Thank you. And then any time that we do a project where the local community or somebody is requesting IDOT additions onto our base project, they would be responsible for 100% of the cost. For storm sewers, utilities, if it's for roadway work that has nothing to do with ours, aesthetics, anything above the base cost is the responsibility of the requesting agency. So that's how we assign and assess the cost sharing levels. Reimbursement options. So we've approached this in many different ways to date. It's usually a percentage is due upon award and a final percentage is due upon completion. Most agreements are 80% of the costs are due upon award, and then the final payment of the final 20% is due upon completion of the project. Some we've got a 50% upon award, others are 50% upon completion, and then a third way we've approached some of this is a portion is due upon award of the contract, a portion is due at midpoint of construction, and then a final percentage is due upon completion. Where this becomes a concern, I guess, for some of the local communities is the, you know, when we're talking about the size of the contract, sometimes we're talking about with interchanges, you're talking multiple millions of dollars, which can be a quick burden on somebody. Or sometimes when we're talking about doing a roadway or bridge projects, we come out, you know, for I-90 example, we're going to be out in another year doing a lot of work in these communities. Do they have time to prepare and plan and budget for what's necessary and get the financing? And you know, those are things that I know the local communities have to deal with within our time frame. Other ways we've approached this, it's been installments, the payments throughout the project with final payment due 1 year after completion or when the roadway is open to traffic. This is, you know, one way. It's a little bit more burdensome on us to make sure that we're out there invoicing on a monthly type basis for work that's been done. Other ways we've looked at multi-year reimbursements for new roadways for I-355. It was the reimbursement was tied to the completion of the capital program, the prior capital program, which was in 2014, so we needed to have pay in full by that date. Other major projects such as I-88 at Naperville Road, it was about 30 some odd million dollar reimbursement that was due to the tollway from DuPage County. That was a five-year payback from DuPage County. There were annual payments throughout 5 years, but the toll was due at the end of the 5 years, so it was a little bit longer. We assumed the full financing for them for the project on that particular one. And some with the new interchanges, we've negotiated a lot of these on a case-by-case basis. Examples, I-294 Balmoral, it was locally financed. We're reimbursing back over time. I-90 at 47, the tollway is going to front the full construction cost of that. We're going to get 90% from IDOT upon award, but the locals are going to have 3 years to reimburse us, with the final payment being due 2 years after construction is complete. But yes, so we're kind of all over on some of these.
But it sounds like, just to break for a moment so we can get some discussion mm-hmm. and feedback, I think would be a good thing to do right now if we could.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like from just the earlier comments that we need to really be looking at also some flexibility in those cases. you know, thinking about kind of that 10-year repayment time horizon and looking at kind of the cost benefit of changing that, particularly in rural areas or areas that Did that make sense based on what you...
Yeah, I'd say you have two things going right now. It's, you know, the local government's in a more difficult position to raise that kind of money quickly, you might say. And secondly, the economic development benefits that could come from the project would argue do that sooner rather than later. So I think when you consider those things, I think we need to look at the policy.
Flexibility is good.
On the issue of installments, are we still open to the ideas, to idea that communities would maybe repay in installments over some period of time?
I think if you base it on need, you know, if you're taking the south suburbs, some of the areas down there where, you know, development has been retarded to a bit, some of it because of maybe bypassing certain areas and not putting interchanges in. When we do put that interchange in, work with the community put some sort of program together, payment plan that they can pay back. I wouldn't say that you skip interest. I think, you know, we have to cover the bond and cost the bond, but not try to make money.
So maybe pass along interest or some of our costs if we do that. But look, certainly installments or something where people pay over a period of time.
Yeah, they're gonna maybe the life of the bond. Give them,
maybe as much as that. Or maybe they can issue their own bonds if they start getting enough revenue
or
from the
system. Even if just the expertise and how to go about with some of the communities, they don't have that.
But the sooner the improvement's made, in a sense, the more likely they'll get the economic development benefit from it and be in a position to pay back. You know, I think that's a key consideration.
So balancing that, I don't know, personally, I'm not sure if, you know, extending it out over to the life of our bonds, but some kind of installment program with appropriate, you know, interest and cost repayment.
I do think that from our own financial planning standpoint that we need to keep it within the framework of our capital plan. And we need a certain amount of resources over that 15-year period for our plan, to complete our plan. And if we're essentially lending or funding someone else's costs, those reimbursements, I think, need to occur within that time frame so we can accommodate the other projects in the total plan. So
balancing some greater flexibility on the schedule with not stretching it out so far that we then as an agency are restricted in future investments that we need to make.
We can see if we can flex it a bit to
help
the cost. The other thing I'd say is that, you know, I'm not sure I see in my mind the completion of a partial interchange that was done with general funds, you know, tollway funds in the first place, that I would see the completion of that interchange as being quite the same as dealing with a request for new interchange per se, and whether or not we should have exactly the same standard applying to both.
So maybe some flexibility in that maybe is one of the criteria, whether it's a completion versus a completely new. It doesn't happen to me anymore, but there were times when I would get off and hope to get back on and have what was possible.
Thoughts of maybe how to handle those differently, what that might be, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, I
start putting pen to paper.
Yeah, I actually like the committee to think about it a little bit, and maybe, you know, we need to think on our own a little bit about that and see what
need-based indicator of how to go forward with
and
it.
You,
it seems like there would still need to be, because obviously there are many, many partial interchanges on the system, but a combination of need, you know, maybe thinking about, you know, some of the threshold flexibility we've already talked about and being different for a completion versus a new, but still, would we still see maybe some, certainly cost participation for a completion?
I don't think we'd eliminate that.
I think in them coming forward, you know, show the economic impact it's going to have. You know, have a plan in place that you can sell it to us. Not to build it, just to build it. We hope it brings it, but an actual plan.
Right.
And when we built those interchanges, we made them one direction for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
But things have changed as we move out to the, you know, west, south, whatever, from the center, things have changed quite a bit, and I think that consideration now, as we go back and look at that, see what the demand is, it's different than it was. And that should be considered.
We have some of these items here, you know, the preference for self-financing, we've talked about that a little bit, maybe balancing that differently, but still, obviously, we would always, I think, prefer for a community to finance whatever portion themselves, but, you know, thinking about that right balance. We talked a little bit about interest or cost, so that's good. Just trying to think if there's anything here that we wanted feedback on that didn't get covered.
Yeah, I think that, you know, really from, to help me with the policy, it's really kind of get that some of the thoughts and ideas if you have on the equity issues. Yeah, flexibility, I think that's nice to have that. And interest, that's something we haven't done in the past. And I know we've struggled with what do we do about
right.
this and what's a fair rate.
Right, that cost, that's all of our costs, not just our interest costs, but obviously there are other costs for us. I think we could, just given that there's a desire to do it, we could maybe come back with a proposal that makes sense versus, you know, obviously there, we talked about rural areas, we talked about areas that are, you know, have had more challenges with economic development and just the economy generally. So maybe we can develop some proposals and come back and incorporate those and get your feedback. Is that an easier way maybe to approach it? Okay.
Sure. And again, this is something entirely unique. We didn't do this before. This is something we adopted, I think it's probably 2005, when we realized we were going to be doing a lot of work. Traditional approach was, we're going to do the work, and you're going to pay us 80% up front. Figure it out. We've tried to really develop as much flexibility as we can to deliver improvements for people at their request, and that's why, you know, there's nothing to draw off of on this. So we've learned, again, from what we've done in the past. There's been some things that have been successful. And we hear a lot of questions and concerns expressed from those we've dealt with. So I think we could we'll start putting pen to paper. So that was, you know, really what my plan was after this, is to continue to work with finance, with legal. We've already started talking internally about how to approach this and developing a policy. We'll come back, and again, this will be really for the Move Illinois type projects. We've got some input from you today.
Would we go beyond, and I don't mean on the financing end of it, but in partnering with private entities. For instance, you know, I think right now in Harvey, they're going to redo that rail yard to make a fairly robust intermodal yard. There's going to be some large investments, private investments made in that area. If the railroad or the developing company came forward and said we'd like to partner with putting an interchange here, we're open to that as well.
We have a precedent where this was done, I'm going to say, back in the mid-90s with UPS. Interchange of 294 at 75th. That was, I don't know, remember all the particulars on it, but that one really was UPS saying we really would like to have access at this location.
That was also a state initiative in that whole development as well. But one where the state maybe isn't involved, they just come forward.
I think we should think
of a couple of where that it just makes sense that they're going to come to us.
Right. We should take a look at it. I mean, we've typically done these through intergovernmental agreements, so it's with another government entity. So that's something we would have to think about. But there certainly may be a way, you know, regardless of whether it's a direct partnership with us and that, you know, private entity, or whether, you know, they are working through the local government or county government at some level, but still, the end result is their contribution to something that clearly is going to benefit their project, but also benefit us because we're getting the benefit of all that truck traffic going through that new interchange. So that's a good, we will kind of think about how we could facilitate a partnership with private entities as well. That's a good point. And with more of these intermodal facilities developed and all of these other, as you're saying, potentials for...
There are some large intermodal developments that are...
On the horizon.
Just right up at the cross.
Yep, good.
But in a village like Harvey or, you know, Dixmoor, they don't have the ability to work with these entities. We can step in and help.
Right.
Yeah, and I think if the need is there and the dollars are there, some entity, does it make a huge difference to that entity?
So that'll be our path moving forward then. We'll continue to work with staff to put some of these thoughts and to move something formal. We'll share. It's going to take a little bit of time because this is, again, something different and unique, but that will be the goal, to have to provide a draft prior to our next strategic planning committee. I should look at the next date before I commit to that.
Well,
every other month?
Every other month, so that would be
plenty of time. So that's where we're going to go with this. That's all I really had to say. If you had any other thoughts or questions, anything to share?
Anything else on those issues?
I mean, given that we've been talking about diversity, I guess we'll get back to the members to talk about, because we thought that conversation would be a joint meeting, so we'll need to schedule accordingly, I think, because we'd like to start talking about that, I think, at the next meeting.
Same with finance?
Yes. Should be their back-to-back meetings
right
now.
I will say, you know, while we're on the diversity issue, IDOT is Schneider, but IDOT is backed an initiative to work with some of the unions to mentor at need kids into programs that are like, it's not a pre-apprenticeship, it just prepares them for, making an application and getting an apprenticeship program and getting a decent score based on these. And it's being, our apprenticeship along with the labor's apprenticeship have put in for these grants through IDOT to do this. But I don't know, is that something that we want to look at doing as well as, stepping up and trying to help through whatever, it doesn't have to be, particularly through a union or apprenticeship program.
We should look at it. I think that there are a variety of different types of diversity, right? There's contractor or vendor diversity, there's our own employment diversity, and then there's, diversity on the work sites themselves, our construction work sites, those three areas. So it certainly could be something that complements our current earned credit program, which we've talked about
before. Well, we make these goals and we put these goals in place, on the backside of that, there's got to be assistance in helping to
right.
bring those kids into the programs.
Right.
And most apprenticeship programs right now have been down or shut off for probably 4 or 5 years. There's going to be eventually when the economy comes back, there's going to be a huge need for construction workers and trained workers, and it's going to go through the apprenticeship programs. This is a great opportunity now to get to those diversity goals that we've been trying to do for years. So
yeah.
I don't know if the tollway wants to think about sponsoring programs like that as well.
Yeah, we can look at it as a maybe companion to get to our own credit program, which has been very successful. But as you're saying, kind of creating this pipeline to make sure that we've, you've got a series of steps that people can go through to get some assistance into.
It's almost a $3 million grant to this. And are working this time with apprenticeship programs directly.
Yeah, one of the things that interests me when you talk about diversity is not simply talking about diverse ownership, but workforce. That's all. Okay.
Good.
Any other items you want to discuss before we go to public comment? If not, we typically allow some time for public comment if we have anyone interested in. Excuse me. We'll make that time available now. It appears we have no one to take us up on that today. So any unfinished or new business that requires our attention today? I don't think so. And we have no need for an executive session.
I don't think so.
To my knowledge, okay. In that case, then I would entertain a motion to adjourn the committee meeting.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? We are hereby adjourned. Thank you.